Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past.
Hello, and welcome to episode 12 of Tea Break Time Travel. I'm your host, Matilda Siebrecht, and today I'm savouring a spiced black tea. And joining me on my tea break today is musician and metalsmith Samuel Merrick. And are you also on tea today?
No, I don't have any tea or hot drinks. I'm not a very tea person, I would say.
You're the second guest who's come on and said, I don't actually drink tea. But do you, I mean, just from looking at your work and everything, I can imagine, I don't know, a pint of mead or something.
No, I prefer to not be under the influence of alcohol while walking.
True, yes, working around hot metal, probably not a good idea. And indeed, so as I mentioned, so you are a metalsmith and a musician. How I found you and how I know of you is through your work with Now. I realized when I was looking this up that I don't actually know how to say this word out loud. I've written it many times. Is it carnyx?
Yes, carnyx. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I realized I was spelling it wrong like my whole life. So I was saying like carynx.
Okay.
And with the Y and the, anyway, so yes, carnyx. And so that seems sort of very specific. How did you get into that idea? So prehistoric metalworking and music combination.
It all started in 2019 when I applied for a job in the Gaelic village where I still work now. A friend of mine was the blacksmith of this village and he lived. So I went to apply as a blacksmith because I was doing blacksmithing on my own for something like 6 or 5 years. Then they told me they have a blacksmith and they proposed me to go for coppersmith that I never did before. And at the same time, the manager of the village told me they wanted to make cornix for the village. And of course, I knew what was this instrument. I knew a little bit about it and I was very excited about it. So they told me how to make coppersmithing. I did a few exercise basic things. And then it was pretty easy because I had a blacksmith's background. Mm. And so at some point I started to work on the cornyx to make researches to understand how it was made first. I made the first prototype in 2019. And then the season at the village stopped because it stopped at the beginning of the fall, the autumn. Mm-hmm. And when I went back home, I wanted to make one cornyx for myself. So I made more researches and I finally made a first working prototype.
Amazing. So you said that you started with blacksmithing. And I mean, from what I have very limited experience with this, but from what I remember of blacksmithing and copper working, they're very different metalworking techniques, right?
Yes. Blacksmithing, so it's working with hot iron or steel. Mm. And coppersmithing, it's like tin smith in English. It's working with sheets, layers of copper-based alloy metals like brass, bronze, copper. And you work mostly cold instead of the blacksmithing where you work with hot metal.
And would you say then it took you, I mean, obviously I don't want you to say if one's harder than the other, for example, but I mean, for example, if you know how to do blacksmithing, is it easier to pick up coppersmithing than maybe vice versa? Or are they fairly comparable in terms of the skills you need?
No, I would say it definitely helped me to have made blacksmithing before. Because you work with hammers, with pair of tongs also, and you need fire also at some point for warm up your metal in coppersmithing. Yeah. So it was the same tools basically. and the same way of holding a hammer. So yes, it helped to have made some blacksmithing before.
And did you also then kind of specialize when you were doing it as, I guess, a hobby before, did you specialize in historic or prehistoric techniques as well? Or were you working as like a modern blacksmith or hobbying as a modern blacksmith?
No, I'm working as a modern blacksmith and coppersmith because working like they did in the Iron Age is very hard. I mean, I'm alone in my workshop and they weren't, obviously, because there was a lot. If you don't have power tools or torch, gas flames, you need to be many people working to have a workflow and to be able to do the steps that you do now alone with power tools.
Yeah, no, that's true. I hadn't really thought of that before because indeed when my very small experience I had with blacksmithing, my husband, then boyfriend at the time, came along to be the bellows boy and do the bellows and everything. And so I guess
you know. For example, it's the welding, the cornices are welded with tin. And nowadays we use a torch flame and a tin wire and the product to clean the metal before welding. But back in time, they had to use flames of candles and also red hot bars of steel to warm up the metal, and it might have been very difficult because today it's not very easy to master tin welding properly with modern tools. So I don't even want to imagine how they did back in time.
A lot of burns, I imagine.
Yeah.
Very thick leather. But did you also, I won't give too much away because we're going to talk about it in a second, but the specialty that you're looking at is from a prehistoric and historic time period. Were you always interested in those time periods?
I used, before to work at this village, I used to be very into medieval things, medieval music, medieval history, medieval things. And then working in this village opened my eyes on the proto-historic and prehistoric and Iron Age times because of that work.
Yeah. No, that's really fascinating. And I think you might be the first guest I have who's more from a European perspective, at least, who's not just prehistory, because I have to admit, probably I'm a little biased in most of the objects I pick are from prehistory, so because I am a prehistorian. So that's really interesting to have someone from both perspectives. And on that note, if you could travel back in time, where do you think you would go and why?
I would definitely go to Neolithic, the end of Paleolithic, and maybe also the Bronze Age. It's time periods I really like because it's full of mystery, and it's also the beginning, the starting point of our modern society nowadays. And it will be very interesting to see how people or society was organized at the time. Also for the Bronze Age, it's because I really love the bronze metal itself and all the thing it represents in terms of transforming the societies and also the way of working the metal itself.
Yeah, you could see how they were doing with what you were talking about before, with welding the pieces together. Well, thank you very, very much for joining me on my tea break today. And before we look at today's object, which we've already mentioned a little bit, we're first going to journey back, this time to 100 BC, to Iron Age, and now I'm probably going to mispronounce this, Tintignac?
Tintignac.
Tintignac, yes. I'm in France. High school French didn't let me down. And unlike our usual peaceful journeys to the past, this one is filled with noises, smells, emotions. Hundreds of people fill the space. The smell of sweat, blood, mud permeates the air. Screams and cries and the clashing of metal on metal, metal on leather, metal cleaving through skin. But then suddenly there's another sound, a loud blasting call that reverberates around the hills and within every head. Looking up to the top of the nearby hill, you see a line of figures, each one blowing into the end of a around 2 meter long bronze horn. Each horn is topped with a beautifully crafted head, wide ears, carved eyes, gaping jaws, from which emits the blasting noise. And that's what we're looking at today, which is indeed, as I've recently discovered, a carinx, not a carinx. And we'll get into the details soon. But first, I always like to have a look at the most asked questions on the internet. And this is when I realized I've been spelling it wrong because I was looking up carinx and nothing was coming up. And I was going, how is this possible? Surely something exists on Google about the carinx. And then I realized, oh, wait, it's not. It's the carinx. So Anyway, here are the questions. So the first question was, what does a Carnix sound like? Which, Samuel, as you have created, I guess, several replicas at this point, you'll have a good idea of this. So what does a Carnix sound like?
Yeah, actually, I can play it for you right now, if you want.
Oh, amazing.
That's it.
Oh, very cool. Thank you so much for playing that. I admit, I didn't even think to ask you to play it. So thank you for offering.
So you have high notes and low notes. Low notes are like a bit like a didgeridoo. Mm-hmm. And then you have these high notes, like which are a bit like a trombone, I would say, or a modern brass instrument.
Mm-hmm. And actually, this relates to the second question, which is, how does a Carnix work? Because I was also curious about this. So I play the French horn. So I'm familiar with that kind of mouthpiece. And I guess it's similar because Carnix don't have finger holes or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm.
No, it's a natural horn, I would say. So you don't have any holes or keys to play the note. It's all by the power of your breathing and the shape of your lips. Mm-hmm. So it's like any other brass instrument. You have to make with your lips to play, to make a sound. And then by mixing the air and the shape of the lips, you have all the notes.
Amazing.
And also, what is very interesting on the mouthpiece of the Carnix is that it is flat. On most of the modern brass instruments, you have some kind of little cup where you put your lips. But on the Carnix's mouthpieces, it's flat. You don't have any cup. So that makes the sound less middly. It removes some middles in the audio frequencies.
Okay, I'm trying to imagine how I would play that. I'm trying to think because I have a horn that I got in some antique market somewhere, which it's not completely flat, but indeed it's got a very wide and flat rim to it, which makes it very difficult for me to play, at least because I'm used to the little French horn ones. Oh, interesting. Oh, amazing. Yeah, very cool. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more in a sec because we're going to go into more detail.
Okay.
But the last question from our lovely audience on Google search is, are Carnix animals? I guess by this they mean the kind of design of it.
Well, it certainly has an animal head on the top. The word Carnix itself refers to these animals because the word Carnix is a Greek word that comes from northern Africa. In French, it has the same etymology as carnassier, carnivore, carnivorous. And so it refers to this animal.
Okay. So it's not necessarily a particular kind of animal. It's more a sort of type.
Yeah, actually all the Carnixes found in the ground are wild boar, except one in Tétignac, which is a snake, and the archaeologists think it might be a snake with goat horns, but the goat horns were never found because the snake with goat head is a very common figure in Celtic mythology.
Interesting. Do you replicate the same kind of design each time, or do you base it on a design but it's your own design, or how does that work?
I always make the same head and the same Carnix. I base my work on the discovery of Tintignac. In this discovery, there is six Carnixes found, and it's something like four or five different heads. I don't remember exactly. So I picked one head and I picked one pair of ears, but we don't know if that ear were linked to that head. And also I picked one crest, but we don't know if that crest belonged to the same head and ears, Carnix. because most of the time, if you type Carnix dentiniac in Google, you'll see one Carnix. It's the biggest one, mm-hmm. and that one is very famous, but that one is very well made by all the coppersmiths. Mm-hmm. So I decided to make another one that was not made based on the discovery of dentiniac.
Okay, interesting. And that's really interesting then that they wouldn't have necessarily all been the same. Like they would have all potentially been different mixes.
No, it's different heads every time.
Oh, interesting.
As I said, it's most of the time it's a wild boar, but mm-hmm. it's very different, stylized, and very in a Gaulish, in a Celtic style. So it's very with weird shapes.
Mm-hmm. And how many of the kind of archaeological pieces have you looked at? Would you say it would be each design is from a different coppersmith, or could it be that the same coppersmith is making variations with each replica based on your own experience as well?
It's interesting. It's very interesting, but very few heads were found by archaeologists, head of Cornix. Mostly so in France, in Dentignac, six heads, but two or three of them are not full. Also, in north of France, a long time ago, a small piece of the left side of another Cornix were of a head, I mean, were found. Also in Italy, in San Zeno, I think, a piece of the head. And they are all kind of similar in style, but different from each other. And then you have the famous Deskford Cornix found in Scotland. And this one has a very different head than the one found on the continent, I would say. So, of course, every cornices found nowadays were made by different crafters because they are very spaced in time. I mean, the Cornix in Dentignac, I think, belongs to the first century BC. Mm. But the other ones in the other parts of Europe are older or younger. So they were made by different people, but you can see some kind of same style in it. But that's for the Cornix of Deskford. It's a very different style in it.
Is that the one where I'm just thinking of Brave, the Pixar film, and there's like a
Cornix featured
in that one? Well, and it's got like a tongue?
Yes, a wooden
wiggles?
Tongue.
Yeah. I found that
It's way more round.
Yeah, and it's got like big eyes, the kind of round eyes.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I know the one.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So on which note, let us move on to the next section. So we do know a bit more about the Cornix. Thank you, Google Search, and thank you, Samuel. But perhaps you could tell us more about it. So we've already talked a little bit about kind of the physical evidence that we have for Cornix. And I mean, it sounds like there's not that much, actually. Do we have other like written evidence for them?
There is written evidence and there is also visual sources. The written evidence were written by Greeks and Romans people talking about the Celtic tribes. And they said most of the time that they used the Cornix on the battlefield to put fear into the enemy and to make themselves strong before the attack. And also sometimes, that is a bit weird, they said they make very high-pitched notes with it. And they also said that there is a lot of this instrument on the battlefield. But it does not refer specifically as the Cornix. They said brass instrument in general.
Okay. So do you think that there may have been multiple types? I mean, what other... now I'm speaking as someone who has absolutely no idea about this, but I mean, how many different kinds of horn brass instruments were there at this time around Europe or in the Celtic countries?
We don't really know. During the Iron Age for the Celtic tribes, it's mostly the conics. But during prehistoric times in Ireland, for example, you have very many different horns, bronze horns. But that is way before the Iron Age. But the problem with this instrument that it is that it can be remelted, and it is a very expensive metal. So I think when people did not have the use of it anymore, they just remelted and make new objects in bronze with it.
Mm. Even back then, the arts were just not appreciated. They were remelting down all these instruments. Yeah. Indeed, you mentioned just then, and we sort of talked about when we did our little time travel segment as well, that the assumption is that they were used in battle. Do you agree with this? I mean, I assume that you don't use it in battle now when you have your replicas.
No, I don't have a lot of use in battle with the conics. But that was what the Greeks and the Romans brought us. And it might be true for sure, but also they didn't write many things. But thanks with the discovery of Tintignac, archaeologists also think these instruments were used during religious rituals and ceremonies, because the conics of Tintignac were found into a Gaulish sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And also the cornices were destroyed by the Gauls before to be put in this sanctuary in the ground.
Interesting.
Yeah, like, you know, sacrificing the weapons, the swords, destroyed and put in the ground. So the same way. So this is why archaeologists think it might also have been used for rituals. And also very interesting, on the cornices, the mouthpiece is straight, not curved. So it's very hard to play it in the battlefield, because you need to have your head back, bounced back to play the conics. Or you have to be two with someone holding it in front of you. You don't have a curved mouthpiece. I don't know if you see what I mean.
Yeah. So you have to have your head. Yeah. If it's going to be straight up, you have to have your head like all the way.
Yes. So it's not very convenient on the battlefield. And all the mouthpieces of cornices ever found are straight. There is only two mouthpieces found, one in Tintignac and one in San Zeno in Italy. And they are both very similar. And both of them are straight. And we never found any curved mouthpiece for cornices. But speaking of what I was saying 2 minutes ago, I said also you have visual representation of the conics. Mm-hmm. And one of the most famous is the one of the Gundestrup cauldron.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see a military protest and three people playing the conics at the end of the protest.
Oh.
And they're playing the conics with the head right, not back.
Okay.
So like if the mouthpiece were curved. But this cauldron is a bit of an issue, because it was not made by Celtic tribes. It was made by a Central European tribe. I don't remember the name.
Oh.
And it was made for Celtic tribes. So the people creating that design were not Celts, and we don't even know if they already saw before conics in use. Because when you get closer and look at the mouth and the mouthpiece of the conics, you can see it's not very clear. It's a bit weirdly shaped, like if the artist didn't knew how it was really made.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's almost similar to all those medieval tapestries, right, of picturings of hairs, and they just look like, I don't know, rhinoceros or something. Like, you know, you can tell the artist was told, just do this animal, and they had no idea what it looked like. Yeah. So I guess someone was told, do a conic, and they were like, okay. I guess I'll do it this way. Which then, with your replicas, are you making them also then with the straight or with curved?
I make both. Mm-hmm. Customers can order straight, curved, or both. I also made a screwing system that allows you to switch mouthpieces.
Oh, clever, clever. And so when you play the straight one, because I'm just thinking from a brass playing perspective, it would be so hard just to get the airflow if you've got your head all the way back. So, I mean, when you play it with a straight mouthpiece, do you have it kind of lying flat instead?
Yeah, when I play on stage with my band, I have a leg holding the conics, so I play it in front of me. It's very more convenient. But when I make the demonstration at the Celtic village, I play it with my head bounce back to show people that it was how it could have been used back in time.
Amazing. Oh, that's really interesting. And indeed, that's really interesting that it was depicted by other people in a different way. So yeah, you don't know how much, whether people maybe did see it, and indeed they did, the Karnix were straight up, but then they weren't really paying attention to the heads of the players, or whether they just assume, oh, it's this really long thing, therefore it must be played straight up. Oh, fascinating. Because also, now I'm just really thinking about this, because the heads, I guess if you would play it, when you play it straight, do you play it that the head is facing up, or the head, like the head of the Karnix is facing up, or the head is facing down?
The head is facing up.
Yeah, which, because otherwise the sound would go into the floor. So
Yeah, it's way more interesting to have the sound with the head up.
Oh, fascinating. Now I want to try one and see how it is. But one day, I will try one. And so, yeah, no, that's really fascinating. And then we've talked a little bit already about that there are other kind of brass instruments. And I guess, I mean, obviously nowadays you don't have like horns in battle, but like in historic times and even medieval and kind of pre-modern times, you had still that idea of the heralds in battle kind of coming in with the horns. So I guess it has developed from that, would you say? Or do you think it's kind of the Karnix? Because the Karnix... Yeah, sorry, Karen.
It's very interesting to see that brass instruments are still in use in the military purpose, I mean. And they obviously it was also back in the Iron Age. And I think it also was during the Bronze Age because of the Scandinavian bronze lures. You know, this S-shape horns. That comes from the Bronze Age in Scandinavia, mostly Denmark, also a little bit of northern Germany and south of Sweden and Norway. These are very big horns, mostly found by pairs, and they are from 1000 BC, something like that, I think. And we also think they were used in battle. So the history of brass instruments during battles started way back in time.
I mean, let's be honest, they are the most epic sounding instrument. I always say when we're listening to films, I always sort of nudge my friends and go, that's the French horn in the background, because it always just sounds so cool. If you have an epic film soundtrack or anything, it's always going to be brass instruments.
And you also have to think that back in time the word was very more silent, so having this kind of sound were really extraordinary.
True. Yeah. It would have been frightening. To have that loud, and especially, I mean, out on a battlefield. But even if you were in any kind of inside or kind of echoing area, it would have been even more so. Yeah, fascinating. Oh, amazing. So, because the Karnix is indeed associated, as you mentioned before, with kind of Celtic peoples. And this idea that you said as well before, with the style and the design is very much kind of Celtic style as well, with the animal heads, the boar head or the snake or that kind of thing on the top. Do we see that? So instruments with animal heads on them or that kind of thing progress after the kind of end of the Celtic, I don't know what you would call it. It's not really the end of the Celtic culture, but when it kind of moves on and progresses in time, do we see that continue, or is it limited to the sort of early Celtic peoples?
So do we see an evolution of the Karnix in
time? Yeah, I guess that's an easier way to say what I was just saying in about 27 words.
No, I don't think so. I don't have in mind any other kind of horns with animal head at the top. I don't think I came across that, except for the Karnixes. When the Celtic tribes, the Celtic people were mixed to the Romans and other cultures, I don't know. It's mostly, I speak for the French point of view, where it mostly became a Roman culture. And I don't know. I don't think these kind of horns were very in use anymore.
Which is such a shame, because they're so cool.
Yeah.
Think. I mean, do you think that maybe they were just, I don't know, the Romans or the next people who came and were conquering just sort of thought, nope, this isn't in line with what we think?
I don't know. I have no idea. And also, as I told earlier, it could be remelted to have the metal reused. So, yeah.
Oh, which is just so sad to think how many possible characters there were. But I find that really interesting. I also always find it interesting. I mean, I use the term Celtic in this podcast, but that term in itself is very problematic, I guess, because there's so much diversity within it. And indeed, like you said, they were kind of mixed in through all these things. But it is interesting that you do have objects like the Carnyx, which are kind of, they can be associated with that concept, I guess, the Celtic concept, which is always interesting. And I'm also curious, I just wanted to ask as well, so you had experience as well before with playing brass instruments. You mentioned a band already. Is that also something that kind of affected how you look at this, at the archaeology? So when you're creating replicas, does your understanding as a musician affect how you interpret the archaeology, or is it sort of, how does that work in your process of replication, shall we say?
I never played any brass instrument before the Carnyx, but I play a lot of other instruments, string and wind instruments also. Mm-hmm. And when I first remade the Carnyx based on the archaeological paper of Tintignac, I had to tune it because it was not tempered, as we say. It's a musical term that means that it's in the scale of the Western modern music. Mm-hmm. So I had to tune it to be able to play this instrument with other modern instrument. Otherwise, it will sound false, wrong.
Interesting. Which, I guess is something, I mean, that's always something when they talk about kind of ancient music and all of that, that it's so based on our interpretation or how we play it and all of that kind of, I didn't even think about the tuning side of things.
Yeah. So every time I make a Carnyx, I tune it, but not if the customer wanted like the archaeological tuning, I just leave it that way. But because it's mostly for playing with other instruments, I tune it. So I just have to cut the beginning of the tube and try until the notes are right.
Mm. Have you ever gone too far and then it just gets to the head and you're like, ah?
No, I'm very careful.
No, but that's also fascinating. And actually, I'm curious, I said in our little time travel section that they're about 2 meters long. How big are they, though? I'm sort of picturing in my mind 2 meters, but I couldn't find any real...
Do you mean the length of the Carnyx?
Yeah.
No, it's not 2 meters. It's 1 meter and 70 centimeter high.
Okay.
Something like that. It's as tall as a person, basically.
Yeah.
But you also have the ears and the crest that can be very big. Mm-hmm. But the tube itself, it's just as tall as a person.
And the way that it's made, I mean, I'm assuming like the head is hollow?
Yes, it is.
And is there any kind of shaping within the head kind of compared to the shape outside or...?
Yes, because there is the shape outside, but you have to hammer the metal by inside to make the line goes outside. So you have the inverting design inside the head, and the head is working like a bell on the modern brass instrument. Mm. It amplifies the sound, and also the ears are involving the sound a little bit because they are vibrating and making some kind of reverb.
Interesting.
That is why also archaeologists think that why their ears are so big on the Carnyx.
Oh, yeah. Which makes sense why you then put like horns and ears on a snake. Otherwise it would be a very boring instrument, I guess, because it would just be the head. But that must mean as well that every different head shape type animal thing also creates a slightly different sound.
Yeah, but it's very minor changing the sound, I would say, because what will be very impacting the sound on this instrument is the diameter and the length of the tube itself.
Okay.
But as I told earlier, continental style of Carnyx head almost sounds the same, but the one in Scotland, in Dexford, is a very different head, and it's also a very different sounding, according to John Kenny, which is a Scottish conics player, mm-hmm. which play both. He has a replica of Tintignac and also a replica of Dexford.
Oh, cool.
And he says they are very different in sound because of the head.
Well, and because the Tintignac one, like I say, I can maybe just remember this tongue from the Scottish yeah. one. Like that must be, because the Tintignac one doesn't, one doesn't have anything inside the mouth, right?
No, it's like an open mouth.
Yeah.
And the Scottish one is more closed, like a human head.
Mm-hmm. I'm now really curious. I will try and find a link of that being played.
Yeah, you can have you have on YouTube. You just type John Kenny Conics and you have him playing both of them and telling this.
I will find the link to that and I will put it in the podcast notes so that people can listen, because I want to listen to that now and hear what the difference is. I've always wanted to play one. I think they had some. I was at a conference somewhere and they had. I can't remember if they were Carnics or if they were just horns, but the long horns, and I really wanted to have a go, but there was a long line of people and I had to go back to the conference. But one day I will play a Carnics.
Hey there, did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so we did already introduce you a little bit, Samuel, in the beginning of this episode in terms of your kind of metalworking background, but I thought we could maybe talk a bit more about the music side of things and also, of course, your business that you have making the Carnics and your work as a musician. So you founded a band, I believe I saw, and I apologize, by the way, if any of this information is incorrect. GoFunnel.
Yes, you can say
GoFunnel. And we're also part of another group, Nerdgoth. So what kind of music, what was your inspiration for creating those groups?
So I created these bands way before I started to recreate the Carnics. And GoFunnel is my the band I created in 2016, and it's some kind of folk, acoustic, pagan folk, or dark folk music, using modern both and ancient instruments in it. We just added the Carnics in it something like 1 or 2 years ago, so it's very recent. And I don't have any album yet, recorded album with the Carnics in it, but I'm working on it.
Excellent.
And the other band, Nethergoth, it's Celtic punk music. And it also started way before, but I didn't create it, this band. It's a band I joined something like 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I play guitar in it. And we also added the Carnics on the live set a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always curious because I mean, I love that style of music and everything. I always loved it. I used to attend a lot of like medieval festivals and things, and you always have these amazing bands that I guess are similar styles and just such cool music because it's, using these slightly different instruments to what you're used to, but it's kind of recognizable enough. But do the members of your band, I mean, were they kind of, shall we say, modern musicians and then became interested in more historic times? Or was it straight from the beginning? I mean, like you, your first experience with brass instruments was the Carnics.
No, in GoFunnel, it's mostly traditional musician or folk. And so they are very into historical music. Mm-hmm. We have two teachers in the band also, in French and Occitan. And also we have another musician that comes from a medieval band. these are people very interested in historical music. And in Nedergott, we are 9 on stage, so it's very different people, but it's also people that come from both either metal music or traditional European music.
And in terms of, I mean, we spoke very briefly before about the fact that when you are looking at, for example, ancient or prehistoric music, so before things were written down, before notes were written, I guess, I mean, how do you think those sounds that we now associate in the modern day, I mean, like I was just saying, I go to these, you know, medieval festivals and I hear the music and I'm like, oh yes, that was definitely what they were playing back then. But I mean, I don't know. What's the kind of earliest music that we have? Do you know, like how no, far back no does idea. It go?
I know the Greeks during antiquities had written music. So I think that the oldest European music you can find. But yeah, I think the Greeks ones, you have the aulos. It's someone playing two kind of reed instruments at the same time, like two oboes. Mm-hmm. And you also have the lyre. And singing and drums, I think, if I remember correctly.
Okay. And would they have used the same, like, musical notation that we do?
I don't think so. I don't know a lot about it, but I think it's very different.
Yeah, that would be, oh, that'd be real. Yeah. Now I'm curious.
But I know that there is people specialized in it that replay the written music of ancient Greeks.
Okay. So oh, I'll have to look that up. See if I can find. Because, yeah, that would be really, I mean, that's, I guess, the closest you can get almost to replicating past music. And as you sort of mentioned, your musical work in those bands, but also by yourself, has sort of focused a lot on the kind of, I guess, Northern, Northwest European music, kind of the traditional music and the folk music, I think. Is that correct?
It depends. On Gofannon, we have influences from different parts in Europe. Mm-hmm. I sing most of the time in Occitan. Occitan is one of the regional languages of Southern France. Mm-hmm. But in France, regional languages are dying. It's like almost nobody speak them anymore. Mm-hmm. And of course, these languages came with a culture, with dances, with music, with dressing. So we also sing traditional songs from Occitan, Southern France.
Oh, cool.
So that is more Mediterranean music, I would say.
Okay.
But we don't really play it Mediterranean. We tend to make dark music. Mm-hmm. Close to the heavy metal scene vibe, I would say, but using acoustic instruments.
Okay.
And also I sing in English and in a little bit in Swedish and in French. And yeah, I'm also very, I like a lot Scandinavian music. Mm-hmm. And in the band, we have someone playing a bass, nickel harpa, you know, the Swedish violin with keys.
Okay.
So that is a traditional Swedish instrument bringing a very northern sound, I would say. We just have many different influences in Gofannon from all over Europe. And in Nedergott, it's a little bit of the same, I would say, but it's more punk and metal. Mm-hmm. We have a punk drum and high gain guitars, and we also play a traditional song from Eastern Europe and Mediterranean and Northern Irish Celtic, I would say.
Mm-hmm. No, I always find it. So I was trying to research the history of drums the other day, slightly unrelated, and I found it really interesting how the kind of earliest evidence for drums that we have come from all these different parts of the world. And even though they're the same basic instrument, it's slightly different in each part. So I'm always curious with people who work with kind of historic music, sort of how much international influence as well there would have been. Or, I mean, do you think there would have been more interaction between different, I don't know, musical cultures, shall we say, like back in the past?
I don't really know. We know for sure people still from also already in prehistoric times, people were traveling a lot. And there is instrument found in Europe. I'm thinking about the rhomb. I don't know the English name of it. In French, it's rhomb. It's a piece of wood or bone, flat, attached to a rope.
Ah, that you swing around.
Yeah, you turn
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Oh, it makes
some kind of motor sound.
Yes, yeah, which is very popular in Australia, right?
Yeah, it's very popular in Australia. It's still used, and it was also found the same instrument in a cave in Germany, something like 20,000 years BC or something like that.
Amazing. The first German, you know, backpacker had gone off to Australia, done his year abroad, backpacker. Oh, what are they called?
We found similarities, instruments. Mm-hmm. Like that, a bit everywhere. Like also the Jew harp traveled a lot from Asia to Europe.
That's the one you have in your mouth between your teeth.
It's in metal. It can also be in wood.
Which I hate playing.
I have one here. It's that one.
Very cool. So that was sort of found everywhere as well.
Yeah, yeah. We know this instrument traveled a lot. It's found in Europe, in Asia, in southern Asia, close to Australia also.
Mm, interesting. So yeah, so there definitely was a lot of interaction, which makes sense because it's a very international language, I guess.
Yeah.
Music, one of the few. and I happened to notice when I was looking on your Instagram, and I think it is something that would be interesting to mention, you very specifically state that you do not welcome neo-Nazis, fascists, or nationalists. And I remember speaking to other friends who, for example, are very heavily involved in Viking reenactment or that kind of thing. They have similar issues, that there's kind of that overlap a lot of the time with those groups and that kind of time period. Do you have a big problem with these groups because of your focus?
I don't have a lot. I don't know if it's because I said I won't want them on my Instagram. Maybe I hope so. But yeah, it's the problem when you are speaking about European history and mostly white European history, you will attract this kind of people. And I don't want them to use my work, you know, to suit their needs or their fantasies.
Mm.
No. So this is why I specifically say that they are not welcome. And they used to message me sometimes, and these kind of people, and now actually I would say a bit less.
I mean, you have made it very clear. Yeah. they are unwelcome. But indeed, I always think that's such a shame that you have, I don't know, that indeed these parts, it's very specific parts of history and that are so... Yeah, sensitive now. Like you can't always be as passionate about it necessarily as you want to, because people might assume the wrong thing as well. And which is it was mainly just I was really interested that it was so specific. I wondered if you'd had any particular problems.
No, it's just I don't want them to use my work.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. Yeah. And indeed, so you decided to focus on creating. The Carnyx, I've spelt it wrong here again. Yeah. I was about to say Carynx, but no, it's the Carnyx. With your business, Obrador, Forge and Craft. But that seems a very specific niche. What are the sort of advantages or disadvantages of that kind of specialization, would you say?
Advantages that we are very few in Europe making this. I think we are something like 20 in Europe. I think something like four or five in France. And most of the people recreating the Carnyx are not musicians. And I really wanted to bring this instrument into a musical context. Yeah. Thanks. We are very few to do it, but that means also a lot of people, it's a bit surprising, but a lot of people want a Carnyx.
I want one.
People are messaging me quite often about how to get one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I even if it's a very a niche thing, I have a lot of order. So I don't see a lot of disadvantages in it.
Hmm. That's good.
And I really enjoy making them, and I specifically want to make only that for the moment, to be better at it. Because every time I make a Cornix, I try to make the next one a little bit better and better and better. So I'm always trying to modernize the tools and kind of things like that.
And are you, I mean, the customers that you have, are they kind of like museums that need replicas, or are they just individuals who are interested, or like what's the range?
There is a bit of everything. It is musicians, not musicians, just people liking history or that does not want to play or know how to play an instrument at all. Also bands, sometimes famous bands. I made the first one I made for Elevati.
Oh wow!
Also, sometimes museums. I don't have for now, I think, but I had also few reenactment associations from the Iron Age.
Cool.
It's this kind of things.
Yeah, wide range. That's very interesting. And actually, so do you ever have, when you're playing with, I don't know how, I guess with Corona, the COVID, maybe you haven't had as many concerts in the last couple of years. But have you played at kind of concerts with your Cornix as well?
Yes. Yeah, with my band in Gofenen and in Nedergott, we played during, I would say, the past 2 years or year and a half when the COVID started to end.
Okay. And did you then have people kind of knowing what the Cornix was, or did you get a lot of questions about it?
Yeah. It brings a lot of questions from the audience. Before the show, mostly, and it depends where we play. When we play into some kind of medieval historical festival, people are a bit aware of.
They're all like, "Yeah, whatever, yeah. They've got a Cornix." Yeah, but who doesn't?
In other context, it's people mostly don't know.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating. No, I always like to ask because I think that it's really. A couple of the other guests I've had on here are sort of similar to you in that they have very specific. Mixture of interests that they have combined into a job. And I always think it's really interesting to talk about because I imagine other people might be listening in and going, well, I like music and I like, you know, doing this. So it's, I mean, what would you say that there, it was a slow start or was it something that you didn't think would actually become a job or did you always want to make it into something that you lived off?
I started during the COVID. And I was able to start it thanks to the COVID because I was at home with my pay every month and working in my workshop. Yeah, it started slowly, and the more I did it, I tried to make myself visible on the internet, on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. So I posted a lot of videos and pictures so people can found me. And thanks to that, I was able to have many orders.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And yeah, I mean, congratulations that you've been able to make it into something that you can make money from, because that's always the dream, right? do that. And so just as a final question, so what advice would you have then for anyone else who might be listening and thinking that they maybe want to follow a similar path in their future?
I don't know. It's always very different depending on where you are, what you do at the moment, if you want to start these kind of things. I would say that you must never be, you must never give up. Try, even if you fail thing, it's you have to try and try again. I did a lot of trying. I spent 1 year making the first prototype of the Cornix. And it was a lot of fails at the beginning until I found something working,
which is amazing though, especially considering that you said you didn't even really have experience in copperwork. I mean, I'm amazed that you have managed to be so successful at creating these Cornix. If you didn't really have experience with brass instruments, you didn't have experience with working copper. I mean, that's amazing. I'm very impressed. Okay. Well, I think that probably marks the end of our tea break. Okay. Probably time to get back to work. It sounds like you've got a lot of orders to fill. I'll let you get back to it. But thank you so, so much for joining me today, Samuel. It was really great to talk to you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Nice.
And if anyone who's listening wants to find out more about Samuel's work, everything that we've been talking about today, so Operator Fortune Craft or the GoFanon or Nerdogoth, I will put the link into the show notes. I'll also try to find that video about playing the different kind of Carnix and other kinds of prehistoric music as well that we've talked about today. So do check out the show notes on the podcast homepage. And I hope that everyone enjoyed our journey today, and see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Come.